Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of April 2019. Welcome to episode 47 of this podcast series. The concept of the show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I've read since the last time we had one of these brief chats, which should make this pretty much the books I read during March. These books are listed weekly every Saturday in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com. And I regularly repost those links on Facebook and Twitter, so you can find those. But those posts are not exactly spoilers for this podcast, since those are just lists. And here, there's a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. But first, a little feedback. We heard from Sir Martin of Grey on last episode, or at least on the start of last episode. Just started listening. And I have to say, Nathaniel Wayne pointing out that Frobisher isn't comics only isn't nitpicking, it's a helpful correction. And that's not nitpicking either. I cannot believe that Sir Martin would take Nathaniel's side. But Martin confirmed that dire fact. No, don't worry. I'm objectively and obnoxiously correct. Well, maybe that's the editor part of Martin's personality. That last episode received social media love from Ed Moore, from Teal Productions, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Jason Marcinet from Drawn and Paneled, Luke Giaconetti, Pat Sampson from The Long Box Crusade, Chris Willette, Liz Ann, Clinton from Coffee and Comics, Al from the Resurrections podcast, Sean from Secret Wars and Beyond, Chris from Bat Books for Beginners, The Hammer Strikes, Justice's First Dawn, and Spidey Comics. Thanks for the support, everybody. And now on to the books that I read last month, and as I do on this show, I'm categorizing the books that I read. And first up are the issues I read specifically for podcast appearances, the homework books. And for Quarterman Podcast 134, the upcoming Quarterbin Podcast 134, which will be the second part of our Techno Comics miniseries, I read Technophage 1 and 10. And we have a lot of podcast-related, or we call these podcast-adjacent, books to cover here as well. First, from the 50-cent box at Pulp Reality, I picked up a podcast follow-up book in a series that I covered on Back to the Bins last year sometime, and it's Captain Marvel number 4. And as we say, no, it's not that Captain Marvel, and no, it's not even that other Captain Marvel, or any of those other ones you might be thinking of either. It's the robot who can separate his body, published in 1966 by MF Enterprises. For a book that was largely a business ploy related to copyright and trademark issues, the book is organized in a very strange way. There are 4 10-page stories, but those are each individual chapters of a longer, years-long story about a villain reforming his ways and Captain Marvel keeping him on the straight and narrow. Not a good comic, necessarily. I don't think that. But it was way better and way more experimental than it had any right to be. Speaking of Back to the Bins, that of course is the show hosted by Paul Spatero, Dr. Bill Robinson, and Scott H. Gardner over on the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, along with the occasional guest hosts. They recently covered an issue of a title that nobody on the show had ever heard of, but that I had picked up some issues of last year from the $5 for $1 box at HeroesCon. I picked these up because I recognized the title from a few years back when the author, J.S. Earls, was interviewed on an episode of the old Spirit Blade Underground podcast. This was a 4-issue miniseries, but I just had 3 of them, and that is Pistol Fist, Revolutionary Warrior 1, 3, and 4. It was a nice mix of American history and legend, with Ben Franklin making a significant appearance. I agree with the boys of Back to the Bins, where it felt like a few steps were skipped in the plotting. A few scenes were not explained well enough, but again, the bits of American history, the setting in the Revolutionary War, that all made it a pretty fun read. And I got a care package from Laurel, a.k.a. Mountain Flower One, from the Batgirl Huntress podcast, which I just almost called the Batress podcast. She remembered that we covered New Universe on the Quarterbin a few years back, so when she saw some of Warren Ellis's reboot from 2007-2008, she just had to send them on to me. Ain't that sweet? I love the hashtag comic book Circle of Life, so I ended up reading New Universal 1, 2, and 5, and New Universal Shockfront number 2. This was a pretty cool reboot, actually. It took the concept of the original New You, a celestial white event that causes strange powers to manifest in a few Earthlings, and even uses some of the same names, Starbrand, Project Spitfire, Justice, and updates the concept, modernizes it. To be honest, it makes it pretty dark. But overall, it tells those stories in a more modern, updated way. Not like the ultimate line in terms of being a reboot and retelling at the same time. From what I could tell, there were a total of 10 issues in this New Universal relaunch or project. And I will definitely keep my eyes out for the other 6. This was a very fun read. Thanks, Laurel. Now, you may remember back last year when I had a bunch of cool folks join me for the Dial Q for Quarterbin miniseries, and I got a nice care package from one of those past guests, the aforementioned kind and gentle Sir Martin of Grey. He sent DC Comics Presents 44, a team-up of Superman and Dial H for Hero. This is a few years after the end of that run at Adventure, and this story sort of serves as the transition from that into the backups in New Adventures of Superboy. What I liked about this issue is that someone finally noticed that lots and lots of costume characters seem to show up in this one town. And Clark Kent and Jimmy Olsen head there to investigate. Superman meets our heroes, Chris and Vicky, figure out what's going on with them, but the villain that they encounter is magic-based enough for Superman to have some struggles, and he needs the kids' help, and he gives them a bit of mentoring, a bit of coaching, as to how to work together best with the particular powers that they have at that moment, and it was just a nice, pleasant, enjoyable story. Thank you, Sir Martin. And wow, do we have a lot of books in this category, the podcast follow-up category. I guess the more podcasts I produce, the more comics I talk about, the more comics will eventually fall into this category, I guess, maybe. But be that as it may, between Dr. Ange and the 50-cent boxes at Pulp Reality, I was able to read a nice chunk of a series I covered on Quarterbin 116, Captain Victory and His Galactic Rangers, 8-11. This is from Pacific Comics, written and drawn by Jack Kirby. I twittered out one day that I was reading an issue of this, and Kyle Benning replied, "Man, I love some Captain Victory." Ange referred to this as beautiful, insane, nonsensical, sublime, in other words, pure, unadulterated Kirby. And there is some absolutely beautiful artwork in these issues. Single and double page splashes abound. And I don't talk about art much except for a few particular artists. And Jack Kirby is one of those. In these issues, the team zaps out from Earth, taking on some insane, crazy outer space entities. Beyond that, there's not a lot to say about the story, because that's only a small part of what these issues are about. Fun read, crazy storytelling, and insanely gorgeous art. And now on to new comics that we read right off the shelves. Adventures of the Super Sons, number 9. Our heroes continue to bounce from planet to planet trying to track down Rex Luthor and stop his invasion of Earth. In this one, the boys find a robotic version of Jonah Hex. So this has the potential of two great tastes that taste great together. And for the most part, that's what it is. This continues to be a very fun series, and this issue was one of my favorites so far. Wonder Woman 67 and 68, it's Wonder Woman and Giganta battling Titans, but we learn at the end of issue 67 that maybe they aren't in fact actual Titans in the Greek godlike meaning of that word. So that's a bit of a mystery that's being dropped in here. And in 68, they get some more magical help in defeating the foe stone Titans. Not bad, but I've talked to Em about this, and we aren't sure how long we're going to keep this title on the pull list, to be honest. And from the good folks at Alterna, providers of new comics at the awesome price of $1.50, I read Feast or Famine, number 3, the final issue in this storyline. One thing I didn't like about this storyline was that it was using versions or knockoffs of Einstein and Tesla, and I wasn't sure why they weren't using the actual versions of these two folk. And in this issue, that question is answered. Via a trip to an alternate Earth, they actually discover their doppelgangers, who would be to us the real Einstein and Tesla. So I was glad that that was addressed. In terms of the overall story, it was okay. I think it was a better premise and a better pitch than actual comic book issues, however. Also from Alterna, I read the second of a four-part series, Unit 44, number 2. This mini is the story of a couple of low-end and pretty bumbling federal agents at Area 51 who have forgotten to pay the bill on a storage unit, causing some important alien artifacts to fall into the wrong hands. In this issue, we learn that maybe that wasn't an accident. And maybe those aliens are on their way back to Earth. I really like what this one is doing and where it's going. And on to the general comic reading that I did. Direct from the quarter bins at World's Greatest Comics, I read Detective 507. This was a 1981 issue that wraps up a story of a model-turned-killer mannequin. And as I guess a preview of what we were going to get in the 90s, that is spelled M-A-N-I-K-I-N, mannequin. But there were also two cool backups. One was a Tales of Gotham City story about a violin player who learns that busking on the streets can be as valuable and fulfilling as playing to the rich in the symphony hall. Bob Rozakis also wrote a really fun four-page story, that is right, four pages, in which Batman solves a sort of insoluble locked room type of mystery. It's a fun read. And I also wanted to talk here about a book that Dr. Ange sent in, National Comics Looker, because of its thematic similarity to that opening Detective Comics story of the model-turned-killer. In this one, we have a model-turned-vampire. Also here, our heroine, Emily Briggs, has managed to stay in the fashion business, which fits into the modern take on super-hot, sexy vampires. You can keep Edward and Bella. Looker is, as our old buddy Shag would say,
she is totally hot.
But, as opposed to mannequin, Looker is a hero, protecting her models from the terrible people in the fashion business who would prey on them. Crazy story, but a good read. Let me say this about this character, Looker. If she's my addiction, Ange is my dealer. And from the 50-cent boxes at Pulp Reality, I used book and record store in the town where I teach, which I just learned has dozens of 50-cent boxes. I picked up a bunch of things, including The Creeper 1 Million, which was insane. There were plenty of odd stories in the 1 Million event, but of the half dozen or so that I've read, this one was easily the most crazy of them. And given the character, I don't mind using terms like insane and crazy. For this character, it fits. In Robert Jordan's The Wheel of Time, Dragon Mount Number Zero. This is from the Dabel brothers, who specialize in telling stories in existing universes like Dresden Files or Dean Koontz, or like here, Robert Jordan. I like epic fantasy, but I've never read any Wheel of Time. But it was Chuck Dixon's role as scripter in this issue that attracted me. It was an interesting story, but obviously not meant for someone like me, someone unfamiliar with the underlying world. And one that I guess was sort of a follow-up of sorts to an issue I read last month, which I guess I could have put in that opening segment, which was way too long anyway. But I enjoyed that issue so much last month that when I saw Metamorpho 6, I could not resist. The wacky and hip language is a bit annoying, but the story was great. Simon Stagg is kidnapped and Metamorpho is forced to steal the Eiffel Tower and the Taj Mahal in order to free him. Now, the scenes in India, the language used there, was cringeworthy, no doubt. And if you can't get past that, respect. I understand that. On the weekly blog post in which I posted the cover of this Metamorpho issue, Billy Hogan chimed in. Billy, of course, hosts the Superman fan podcast. What hooked me on Metamorpho were the ads for his short-lived series when I was a boy. I never got to read many of his stories until I was much older, except for the infamous Bat-Hulk story. Yes, I survived Bat-Hulk. Oh, thanks, Billy. Always good to hear from you. Also there at the 50-cent boxes, I found a ton at that store from Innovation and Comico and Hero, some of those publishers from the late 80s, early 90s, that era. And from that bunch, I read Hero Alliance, number one, Legends of the Stargazers, number two, Champions 5 and 12, Flare 5, Flare Adventures 11, Marksman 4, and Headman 1. I'm putting them all together because there are enough similarities in the type of storytelling, the settings, the art. I like sci-fi comics, so there are aspects of these stories that I liked that really appealed to me. And the writing in a few, especially Stargazers, seemed like a prose short story, and that's not a bad thing. Headman needs to get a shout-out here as well because it was another one of those one-shots that was a full, complete story. Good stuff. And I never played the Champions RPG, but I think I actually may have owned it for a little while and knew a few guys who did play. Decent characters in the comics, but not the best stories ever. And a shout-out to a couple of those Flare issues. That was a character I had no knowledge of. But the covers featured a character that I really like from that era who was a part of those books, Eternity Smith. But there is a commonality between a chunk of these books that does need to be mentioned. Because evidently, at some point in the future, how can I put this delicately? It seems that in the future, at least as hypothesized by the Innovation comic book line, brassieres are evidently outlawed, or at least future clothes worn by ladies are made from very thin fabric. And the entire universe, be it planet or spaceship or anywhere else, seems very, very cold. It was the late 80s. I know. And before I discovered the 50-cent bins at Pulp Reality, I found myself in the distressing and embarrassing position of visiting the dollar boxes at Journey into Comics. And there I found Adventures in the DC Universe Annual Number 1 from 1997, at least at that outrageous price, I landed a 56-pager. So there's that. This one told an overall story featuring Dr. Fate learning about a terrible risk to the fabric of reality. And then it tells individual stories featuring Mr. Miracle, Rose and Thorn, Zatanna, Superboy, and Impulse to tell that story. And these are all in the style of the DC animated shows of that era. So the story was a little silly, a little simplistic, but it was all ages, and the art was all ages. Overall, not all that bad. Dr. Ange sent in some books recently for me to read, and some to go into the prize pool for the relatively geeky NCAA Brackets Challenge, and I grabbed one of those to read first. So after this, it went, along with about 20 other comics, to Ross Michaud, Old School Ross, a smaller bunch of comics, went to the second place winner, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us. But like I said, I grabbed one of those prize books and read it myself, and that was X-Men, Phoenix, End Song, number 1. From 2005, the Phoenix Force is on the loose, and that's about all I could figure out from this issue. Like I've said before, I do not have a lot of reading experience with the X-Men titles, certainly not from this era, so to say I was lost would be a little bit of an understatement. Dr. Anthony, the engineer, sent a packet around New Year's Day, which had a cool bunch of books in it, such as Exciting Comics, number 1, from Antarctic Press from earlier this year. I like that Dr. Anthony seems to frequent the smaller press books, and that, I don't know, the ones he doesn't like, I guess he sends to me. I don't know how that works, but I'm not complaining. This one was an anthology, the first chapters of three different stories, all featuring characters inspired by the Golden Age, the pulp era, and that's an era that I dig. Characters I tend to dig. So I enjoyed this. I'm cautious to say that, not knowing how any of these individual stories end, but I do definitely like the way that they all started. And from Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, I read from Topps Comics from 1996, Hercules, The Legendary Journeys, number 1. If I had ever watched a single episode of that show, I may have liked the comic more. We sort of had that Wheel of Time situation again. But even with that, Roy Thomas did a solid job writing a pretty approachable, interesting first issue. And Sir Iwas Joe sent in some books recently, including an Image book from 2017, an Extra-sized anthology, another of those. This one is called Packless, number 1. It's spelled P-A-K-L-I-S, Packless, number 1, with the outrageous cover price of $5.99. I can't believe I even just said that. Thank you, Joe, for sending this in. All the stories in here are by Dustin Weaver, who did the art and the writing, and all of them are, again, sci-fi to some degree. The last story takes up about half of the 50 pages in this, called Amnia Cycle, about a lady pilot who steals a space plane during wartime to follow a personal passion project. Drama, excitement, good visuals, good story. Overall, not a bad issue. And then there were some kids' books that I read, some from Sir Rob Lance's care package, some from the Quarter Bins, some from Ron Sadowski, some from my brother-in-law, Phil. And I read Archie Comics Digest, number 1, Mighty Mouse, 163, Betty's Diary, 9, Laugh, 282, and Archie, 440. It was fun reading Archie Comics Digest, number 1, from 1972. The Digest obviously became an important point in the history of Archie. You know, Digests have been part of their business plan for now nearly 50 years. And I've always been a fan of Mighty Mouse, loved that TV show growing up, and the comic book was surprisingly solid. Okay, let's take a break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about a couple of publisher-provided books that I've received recently.
Andy, I have an amazing idea. Let's do a podcast. We've been talking about doing this for years. That sounds great. So, what should we talk about?
Something no one else is talking about. Batman.
Mike, there are hundreds of Batman shows out there. You used to do one.
True. Well, maybe we could do an index show.
Are you insane? We both already host those.
True again. Okay, maybe we could talk about Batman stories no one else does. Like the Jerry Conway run.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we could discuss his entire run and then go into the Doug Mensch run.
But we won't be tied down to that. We need to be free to talk about other Batman stories from that era as well.
And we could call it the Overlooked Dark Knight, the non-index index show.
Great!
I guess we should do a trailer.
I think we kind of just did.
Yeah, but it's missing something. Like, you should have added music behind us or something.
Andy, I have an amazing idea. Let's do a podcast.
We've been talking about doing this for years. That sounds great! So, what should we talk about?
Something no one else is talking about. Batman.
Mike, there are hundreds of Batman shows out there. You used to do one.
True. Well, maybe we could do an index show.
Are you insane? We both already host those.
True again. Okay, maybe we could talk about Batman stories no one else does. Like the Jerry Conway run.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we could discuss his entire run and then go into the Doug Mensch run.
But we won't be tied down to that. We need to be free to talk about other Batman stories from that era as well.
And we could call it the Overlooked Dark Knight, the non-index index show.
Great!
The Overlooked Dark Knight, the non-index index show. New episodes drop on the 14th and 28th of every month from the Fortress of Baileytude Podcasting Network.
There's an old saying that we've mentioned here more than once about being a radio personality that also applies to being a podcaster. And that is that you go into this line of work for three reasons: to help your friends, to crush your enemies, and to get free stuff. Now, I don't really have any enemies. I mean, sure, Shag, but he's more of an annoyance, to be honest. And I certainly hope that I've helped my friends, but we all know that this show in particular, the Comics Reading Journal, is evidence about that final part, the getting of free stuff. Now, of course, mostly that free stuff comes from lovely listeners, many of whose names you've already heard in this episode, or many past episodes, or maybe later in this episode. But I also, and it doesn't happen all that often, but it does happen, get approached by creators who offer free stuff in exchange for a review. And what I tell anyone who makes this offer is that on this show, the Comics Reading Journal, I talk about every comic book that I've read in the course of a month, no matter how I feel about that comic, good, bad, or indifferent. I say that I will be honest. And to be honest, after hearing that canned standard reply from me, some creators have not followed up, have not sent me their comic for review. But when I gave that answer a few weeks ago to veteran comic book writer Christopher Mills, he was not scared. He was not fazed. He went ahead and sent me a PDF of Space Crusaders number 1. And I have to give a shout out to Kirk Spencer on Twitter, Big Five Army, for letting me know that Mills was making this offer to podcasters and bloggers and other reviewers. And the blurb that Christopher Mills included with the copy of Space Crusaders was this: Space Crusaders is the first release from my new self-publishing effort, Atomic Action, a line of comics published under my Atomic Pulp imprint. The Atomic Action comics feature new versions and adventures of public domain Golden Age comic characters, presented in a style and format intended to evoke a late 70s Bronze Age feel. Well, the cover of Space Crusaders number 1 features Rex Dexter of Mars, a Golden Age character originally published by Fox Features and created by Dick Briefer. Christopher Mills wrote and lettered this issue, with art by Peter Grau and colors by Matt Webb. The scene for the story is set by the opening narration box. Rocketing through millions of miles of endless space, Rex Dexter, interplanetary adventurer, and his intrepid companion Cindy, braves the terrors of unknown worlds. Just for your information, Cindy is indeed spelled C-Y-N-D-E. Because comics. In this opening 28-page story, our heroes battle dinosaurs in a prehistoric setting, which is referred to once in the story as a strange and savage land. I see what you did there, Christopher Mills. And so we have some Rex versus Rex action, which is Rex Dexter versus a T-Rex. And by doing so, in a way that I won't spoil, he and Cindy actually end up saving Earth. And they pick up another team member along the way, and we are set for the story of the next issue. Now, the second story here in issue one is the first part of a serialized backup featuring Lance Lewis, space detective. This time, the art is by Nick Polipko, and again, Christopher Mills delivers a story that feels both modern and old school at the same time. I read a few space detective stories a few years ago via the Digital Comics Museum. Now, I don't remember if it was the same character, Lance Lewis, or just that concept of the space detective, but the feel was certainly the same. And the story in this one was probably a little bit better. So both of these stories, the Rex Dexter lead story and the space detective backup, do indeed succeed in capturing that Bronze Age feel for books, which is an era I particularly appreciate. So I admit I was inclined to like this, I think. In one of the text pages in the issue, Mills describes the concept of the book as being 25% homage, 25% pastiche, and 50% pure, sincere genre storytelling. And I think that's pretty accurate in terms of what was actually delivered here. Oh, and the story had an actual editor's footnote or two, just to add to that retro feel. And there's also a note about advertising products in Golden Age comic books that is too good to be true, so I'm not going to spoil it here, but I believe it actually is true. All I'm going to say here is Cuba Cola. Now, Space Crusaders number 1, just so you know, is not available in stores, but it can be ordered online now for a print-on-demand copy at www.indieplanet.us/space-crusaders. Or I'm sure if you go to indieplanet.us and just search Space Crusaders, you'll find it. I am quite intrigued by the potential for print-on-demand books. I have been for more than a decade, both in prose and the comic book world. So I love the idea of this experiment, of not spending upfront to print, and then also to store and transport, which are expensive costs that creators sometimes don't consider, but printing copies only as the book is sold. So this is a very solid comic and a pretty high-quality way to kick off a new publishing experiment. The Atomic Pulp line includes sci-fi books like this one, but also detective, and sword and sandal fantasy, and heroes, and monsters. So there's content out there for all sorts of tastes. And wish you luck with the endeavor, Christopher Mills. Now, about the same time that I was hearing from Mr. Mills, our old friend Manuel Carmona reached out to offer up the latest comic that he's produced, Project New Wave number 1. This is from his imprint, Truthful Comics. And we covered a different book out of this imprint last year. Now, Manuel created and drew this, and it was also co-written by Manuel and Alvaro Cortez Ortiz Jr. The blurb on the Truthful Comics website describes this book as a team of young, enhanced soldiers are put together as a special covert team focusing on tackling missions deemed impossible, all under absolute secrecy and unlimited resources. They deal with horrors even our armed forces can't handle, but of course, nothing is ever what it seems. What happens when you have five teenagers with unlimited powers and a shady leader? Get ready. So this one is a more modern type of comic, and it really does succeed at being a modern comic. The interactions between the young protagonists were very strong. The story moves at a brisk pace, and there are some really good artistic bits. The story has that grounded feel, which takes its commitment to being set in the real world. It takes that seriously, while also making room for the more comic book stuff, the more unrealistic stuff, in a way that fits into the world. That doesn't always work in comics, but here, I think that's a strength of this world that's been created, of this comic. Project New Wave is a full-color comic and is rated teen. So check out Truthful Comics for information about this book and the complete line of comics and webcomics that they're producing. Very impressive site, very good and well put together comics. Now Manuel is also the man behind the event Buy Indie Comics Day, which in 2019 is Saturday, August 3rd. The idea behind the event is to shine the light on small press independent comics with the goal of encouraging both retailers and customers to take risks on new comics and new creators that they've never heard of. Manuel and his wife, Hannah Rose, have also founded the nonprofit charitable effort Comics for Christmas, in which they purchase and receive as gifts kid-appropriate comics and give them away at Christmas season events in their hometown of Norfolk, Virginia. Check out the Truthful Comics website again for information about how to donate comics or how to contribute money so the Carmonas can purchase comics for Comics for Christmas. I did that a few years ago, sent some comics for the Carmonas to give away. It's a great idea, and they actually put a lot of effort and time and money into making it something more than just the great idea that it sounds like. So I really appreciate all the things that Manuel is involved in. He has a great heart, an entrepreneurial spirit, and the fella loves comics. Now, if I remember this, I will put some links in the show notes on the blog post for this episode for information about both of these comics. And thanks to both of the creators, Christopher Mills and Manuel Carmona, for letting me take a look at these books. And again, to both gentlemen, good luck with your publishing efforts. All right, it's time to take another break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about graphic novels, trade paperbacks, and long runs that I read in April. And we'll get to that right after this.
Are you tired of fanboy comics podcasts? Looking for a show that really appreciates the comic storytelling medium and how it works? A show that looks at comics from any genre and anywhere in the world, comparing the storytelling techniques of different creators and different comics cultures, with manga, newspaper strips, European comics, and more discussed alongside mainstream U.S. comics? A show that includes talks with well-known creators like James Robinson and Dan Jurgens, and with less famous creators that you really should know. And hey, we'll even critique your comic. If you're looking for that show, then you're looking for Deconstructing Comics, and it's right here at deconstructingcomics.com. Also available in iTunes and on Stitcher. This is Tim saying check out our show every Monday. That's Deconstructing Comics.
And we're back to talk about trades, long runs, and miniseries that I read last month. And we start with a series that I picked up because I saw that it was becoming a Netflix show and wanted to read the series before I watched. I read the first trade in March, and in April, via the Digital Hoopla app, I read Umbrella Academy Dallas 1 through 6. And there is a big difference between the first one, Apocalypse Suite, and this one. Apocalypse Suite had a story, a plot, that I could mostly follow. The world was crazy. The characters were crazy. But there was a pretty standard comic book goal, an identifiable goal. And it made sense how the issues led up to that goal. This one, on the other hand, I had a little trouble seeing how we were getting from here to there. Some of that is because there's time travel involved, and that can muddy up the timeline sometimes. Again, the characters are strong, the situations are strong. The way that the time travel element was handled was mind-bending, but overall this did not hold together as well as I'd hoped. But on the other hand, I can see how this trade prepared Gerard Way to write Doom Patrol. That is for sure. There is a third story arc going on right now, may have actually just wrapped up recently, and I will check Hoopla every now and then to see when it appears there, and when it does, I do plan on reading that. The characters are interesting, and the world is interesting enough for me to give a shot for that next storyline. And I did watch the first season of the TV show. I had heard pretty decent stuff about it, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I thought the scripting, the character bits, most of the performances, all of that was really excellent. There were some odd choices towards the end of the series, a little more maybe traditional comic booky things than Umbrella Academy tends to deliver. But it certainly also managed to capture the weirdness that was going on. It got the tone, I think, quite right. Now, from the 50-cent box at Pulp Reality, I found a complete miniseries, written and drawn by one of my favorite creators, starring a character I really like as well. So when I saw P. Craig Russell's Conan and the Jewels of Gwalior 1-3, I knew I had to buy them. Russell's art is a bit more fantasy appropriate than action comic, but this story does have some mysterious prophecies and oracles and such. So it's a pretty good fit, actually. This one certainly has elements of sword and sorcery, not just sword and sandal. This is based on a Robert E. Howard story, which is always a good sign for a Conan comic. I liked the sense of mystery. The plot had some good twists and turns, crosses and double crosses, and a treasure worth all the risk and all the danger. Really enjoyed this, and I know that Russell's art gave this a different vibe than a lot of comic books, but for me, for my taste, I thought it really worked. And then from Pulp Reality and our good friend, the generous Canadian Sir Rob Lance, I read a trio of disconnected stories featuring that team of blue-clad losers. For reasons I cannot really comprehend myself, I read Fantastic Four, 173, 186, and 358. 173 featured Galactus and was excellent, while 186 featured Salem's Seven and wasn't as excellent. Not a fan of Agatha Harkness in any role at all, really. Those stories just never work for me. Now, 358, that was the 30th anniversary story, which dealt with the revelation that Alicia Masters had been, in fact, Lyja the Skrull for a good long while. Good story that wraps that up and features some other items about the FF and a cutaway of the Four Freedoms Plaza. But all of that is just prelude. Those are just the opening acts leading up to the headline story in this issue. Because, of course, a special FF issue could only have one reasonable, appropriate conclusion. And that is a 5-page story featuring everybody's favorite Latverian leader, Dr. Doom. And that story is quite insightful, focusing on the person whose job it is to edit the historical record. Edit Big Comics' biased view of history, and tell the story that Dr. Doom would prefer. We call it, you know, the truth. And stories that put him in the best light, by definition, if you think about it, are true. In Latverian dictionaries, the definition for truth is that which puts Dr. Doom in the light most preferred by Dr. Doom. Because when you think about it, that does seem pretty reasonable. And from Pulp Reality, I picked up from Eclipse, Detectives, Inc. 1 and 2. Good story, gritty, for mature audiences. But to me, this is what comics from the mid-80s were all about. This was the era I was most active buying new comics from the shop, and I was pretty willing, this sounds shocking, I know, to spend money on new comics. And I shake my head at that now. But books like this, non-hero books from indie publishers, that particular niche, that was what I was looking for. This one missed me back then, but I was glad to pick it up now. Like I said, good story, good comics, a lot of narration and text, like it was intended to be a novel or a short story originally. But the highlight was the 8 or 9 page text piece spread over the 2 issues, in which writer Don McGregor talks about how long this story had been with him, had gestated, and how hard he had tried to get it published. He also takes many, many swipes at Marvel Comics and their contractual practices and all that. Overall, start to finish, a couple of really good issues. Again, from Pulp Reality. I read some more issues from a series I started last year sometime from DC Comics from 1989. It's Doc Savage, 7 through 10. This is two-issue arcs, which gave them a sense of pace and action because they were so fast-moving. I like Mike W. Barr's take on Doc, which was an attempt to modernize him and add some new younger people to the team, but it also kept some of the old guys around, like Ham and Long Tom. So it was a good mix, and even though these stories did take place in the modern age, they managed to maintain that old-school pulp-era feel. And that doesn't always work. I should say that rarely works when you bring Doc into the modern era. But it was a good, solid, very enjoyable couple of reads. And of course, if you're going to a place called Pulp Reality, you certainly hope you're going to find a title like Doc Savage. And from the quarter bins at World's Greatest Comics, I read a pair of books from 1993, Black Canary 1 and 5. These were both the first parts of different story arcs, so I can't speak for how these stories were brought together, but each one of these was a solid start. There were certainly 90s-isms, for sure, both in Canary's costume and the art in general, and also in the name of one of the villains, Blind. I know, that doesn't sound so tricky, but guess how it's spelled. I dare you, come on, guess. If you went B-L-Y-N-D-E, you won! But despite that, each of these was a pretty decent comic book. And from a variety of cheap bins around here, I managed to gobble together a little run of a Bronze Age DC sci-fi series. And generally speaking, I'm a fan of Bronze Age DC sci-fi series. So these were Star Hunters 3-5 from 1978. This was unfortunately the 17-page era of the Bronze Age, so there are a lot of ads in these books. And they do sort of interrupt the flow. But it's not a bad little sci-fi series. It ran a total of 7 issues, so these are the exact dead center of the story. But even so, there's some good action and character bits. Some of the plots, a bit predictable. Big evil corporation, a roguish soldier of fortune, search for adventure, mysteries of the universe, stuff like that. But it's Michelinie, Buckler, and Layton, so it is delivered with a whole lot of skill. Dr. Anthony, the engineer, sent a care package around the holiday season, which included the first issue of a series that I grabbed the first trade of via Hoopla, which is totally the kind of move that Sir Iowa Joe usually pulls, but Dr. Anthony is a quick learner, I suppose. That trade was Mind the Gap, 1-5 from Image from 2012. Jim McCann wrote the story, which is about a young, wealthy woman named Elle who someone tried to murder and left in a coma. But in her spirit form, Elle finds that she may be able to unravel the mystery, not just of her attacks, but of the secret and hidden agendas that she discovers in trying to unravel the details of her attack. Took me a couple of issues to get into this, because it is pretty weird, as that description sort of implies, I think. But once I figured out what was happening and could grab onto enough threads to follow it, I really got into it and found it to be quite a good read. Now, I said that Dr. Anthony seemed to have been consulting with Sir Iowa's Joe because he sent another issue, this time a zero issue, as if that makes it any better. That led me to the first couple trades of that title. So I read from Dark Horse 2013 and 2014, Captain Midnight, 0-7. Joshua Williamson is writing this title, which is an interesting take on the sort of Captain America sort of template. In this version, Captain Midnight, a 1940s hero, disappeared one day, entering the Bermuda Triangle in that era and never leaving, never being discovered. Until the modern day, when he pops out of the sky in his World War II era plane in the Bermuda Triangle with no time having passed for him. It turns out that he has new enemies in the modern age, and that a few of his old enemies have somehow survived to the modern day as well. And when we learn that alien technology was included in his original suit and weapons way back in the 40s, and that that technology has fallen into the hands of his old enemies, from there, things get wild. I like the way the story had gotten going and look forward to reading more of the issues, hopefully, pretty soon. And there was another series that I saw the first trade for and picked up because I dug the number one issue that I read a few months back. And out of respect for Listener of the Year, Nathaniel Wayne, I did not go back to see when I covered that or even who sent me that particular issue. Because that, my friends, would be research. But I did read the rest of this trade, Hinterkind 2-6, which tells a post-apocalyptic story, is there any other kind these days, of what happens when a blight strikes humanity, and we find ourselves not at the top of the food chain anymore. And this is a case of issue one being intriguing enough to be excited, to be interested enough to pick up the first trade, but then having the first trade go in the direction that wasn't what you wanted or were hoping for. This isn't bad, I wouldn't say that by any stretch, but it turns out that this may not be for me. That happens. And I've heard enough about a great recent series where the great Dr. Doom takes over a book from Tony Stark's lackey, but I had not read this great book until just a few weeks ago. So I read the first great trade of Infamous Iron Man 1-6. Of course, the series starts from the faulty premise that Doom was once a villain, a heartless, cruel, murdering tyrant. And yes, that is a major black spot on the story. But if you think of this as like a what-if, or an imaginary story, it kind of works. So I like to think of this series as, what if Dr. Doom started his career as a bad guy? And if you're going to start from that world of alternative facts and fake news, then where this story goes makes some sense. Brian Michael Bendis wrote it, so it is a fast read, and it works very good in trade. Doom decides to, quote-unquote, change his ways and become a hero, a defender of the Earth, which of course he's really been all this time. But he does the reasonable thing of taking Iron Man's armor and modifying it for his own useful and generous purposes. And he does with a few fits and starts here and there. Of course, the troublemakers at S.H.I.E.L.D. like Maria Hill and that ignorant orange rock thing, they don't believe him. Like Doom would ever deceive. I mean, those losers just give him a hard time. But that only makes him stronger, only makes him more committed to do good. The only thing that slows Doom down in these first six issues is his mom, his dead mom, the one he finally rescued from hell, because like a good boy, Victor loves his mommy very much. But a few issues in, we learn that she's alive, and seems to be consorting with a dark version of Reed Richards. I know what you're thinking. They all are. But trust me on this one, this guy's even darker. So those little facts, like her, you know, being alive and stuff, complicate things just a little bit. So this takes me about halfway through the series, and I am definitely going to read Volume 2, like, soon. I also picked up a trade of a comic series I hadn't read anything of for years, because the TV show was about the same point. But now that that most recent season is over, I felt safe reading The Walking Dead 151 through 156, which is basically Negan versus the Whisperers, with a side of Rick and Carl and Eugene and the rest of the survivors. Eugene has made friends over the walkie-talkie with a mysterious female. But again, the key to these issues was Negan escaping and finding the Whisperers. And as good as the Negan versus Beta showdown was, Negan versus Alpha was even better. It was a very good trade, I thought. It's been so long since I've read any of these, literally a couple of years. I did have to get my mind back into the comics universe mindset, as opposed to the TV show universe mindset. But now that I jumped back in, I think I'm going to try to read trade per month over the summer to get closer to being caught up on the comic book side. And from Hoopla, I read the next volume of a series that took a few years off, but I really enjoyed that first volume. So from Greg Rucka and Nicola Scott, I read Black Magic, 6 through 11. For Rowan Black, small town law enforcement professional, and also high-level witch. Her life and career are both facing crossroads. She shoots a man in the line of duty. Her partner's wife is delivering a new baby, and all the while she's being tracked by other powerful beings. Some may be allies, some are certainly enemies, and sometimes it's hard to tell who is who. And there's a talking magical cat, and that is always good. It's a good story, but the key is Nicola Scott's art, which is breathtakingly beautiful and chilling. This is definitely solidly solid comic book goodness. And from Hoopla also, I pushed forward with a recent trade from the current DC run, Detective Comics 982 through 987. In this series, Black Lightning is brought in from Metropolis by Bruce to teach the trainees on behalf of Batman. And Katana also shows up, so there are multiple echoes to the old Outsiders team. If you don't love the concept of Team Batman, then this entire detective run has been off the rails for you from the get-go. But that doesn't bother me. And more important, what they've done with that concept, with the Team Batman concept, makes good sense to me. Such as bringing in Jefferson Pierce to be the school principal slash tutor to this team of misfit heroes. There's a logic to that. And also, if you need Superman and Batman to be BFFs, if that's your jam, then again, this run is not for you. But I like them having some conflict, some level of distrust. And pulling in Pierce, a man from Metropolis, rankles Superman. And to be honest, I don't mind Superman being just a little bit rankled. So I understand that this run, that Detective Comics of late, is an acquired taste, or a particular taste. But it's a taste that has seriously worked for me. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, Adventures of the Super Sons with robot Jonah Hex was a total hoot of a read. Captain Midnight was fun. Captain Victory was insane. Metamorpho was as nutty as all get out, and it was good to get back into The Walking Dead. But the infamous Iron Man was doomerific. So in terms of my favorite issue of the month, I'm going to go with the one where we first get to know this version of Cynthia Von Doom, a.k.a. Doom's mommy. And that was Infamous Iron Man number 4. Now, next month, I'm going to try to knock out another volume of Walking Dead, like I said, and definitely wrap up Infamous Iron Man, and maybe push forward with some Captain Midnight or Mind the Gap. And my semester wraps up early in May, so a lot of next month is going to be during summer break. So I expect that to mean more comics reading than usual. But whatever I do end up reading in May, I will be here to talk about those books. And that episode ought to be out sometime in early June. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of the books that I mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook or blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek. And of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. All are welcome. Thanks for listening, and keep the pages turning.